Whatever the adventure, there's a BMW engineered to take it on. The X3 delivers a striking design with agile performance. The 100% electric i4, packed with pure electric energy. Or the plug-in hybrid X5, an impressive, versatile SUV granting full control on every journey. Choose what powers your next adventure during the BMW Road Home Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. Hurry in for exceptional offers through January 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
97.1 FM Talk Podcast.
Welcome back to the Mark Brudin Show. I am Ethan Hanford. Pleased that you are tuned in on 97.1 FM Talk. We continue on with the best of segments here in the 5 o'clock hour as we near Friday. Back in August, we hit the 10-year threshold since that shooting and death of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, which led to all of those very intense protests and riots, and was really one of the first, it seems like, appearances of the Black Lives Matter campaign. Right around that time, former Ferguson Mayor James Knowles joined the show that 10-year anniversary, which would have been back in August. Knowles, the mayor, like I said, during the Brown shooting and during all those protests, and they discussed the reaction to the 10-year anniversary, different pressures that he faced, and much, much more. Here it is.
We had Chief Fitch on reacting to some of this the other day, and we talked about Ferguson. James Knowles, who's the former mayor of Ferguson, reached out, and it kind of reminded me, James, that we should have had you on last week, by the way, and I always know that you're listening because you reach out sometimes, but why we didn't have you on Thursday or Friday to kind of remember what happened 10 years ago, that's on me. But how are you this afternoon?
I'm doing pretty good, all things considered. I mean, it's really upsetting to hear what happened in our city and the status of our officer, but we do appreciate all the attention, the prayers, and the support that the community has given throughout the region to this officer and his family, and we just only hope that he'll have a good outcome ultimately. There's been some small improvements I've read.
Right, yeah.
He's got a long way to go.
Yes, he does. Now, I'm curious, first and foremost, we'll get to some of the particulars here, but just what your reaction was last week and the build-up to the anniversary and, you know, the lack of attention to some of the specifics and the real facts of the case last week, because this just became a big celebration, didn't it?
It did, and, you know, I made sure that our mayor, who I've regular conversations with, our city administrator and the police chief, you know, they had it on their radar that this might come up. There might be some sort of anniversary celebration for the last few months. Obviously, this they had, I think, an entire week of remembrances and conversations. And, of course, they're rehashing the old narratives and trying to push those and bring those back. And unfortunately, you know, the event that occurred where the officer was injured, you have a situation where, you know, people can't even take the win. You know, they fought for reforms in a police department.
They got a lot.
Yeah, they had oversight that they wanted. They had change that they wanted. They got it, and they still can't be happy with it. And in fact, almost punished the city and the officers for still trying to work with them and listen to them. Because my intuition was that the way that they handled these guys, trying to handle everybody with kid gloves, you know, that puts the officers in danger. And now we see that an officer was injured because this person was clearly, you know, violent, attacked him violently. When you watch that body cam video, I mean, that was a hit.
Tried to get away continuously, didn't comply after the fact, all those things. Now, when I had Chief Fitch on a couple of days ago, you reached out to me and you said something rather stunning to me, and I don't remember ever hearing this, but he made an allusion to the Justice Department encouraging those of you in Ferguson at the time to let the police station burn, just to kind of give it to the protesters, I guess, so they wouldn't keep burning other buildings down. But you had a lot of pressure, James, you're saying, to do that, and there were a lot of different people recommending that course back then?
Well, there was, yeah. So what happened was we got to a point where the officers were exhausted. There was a real concern about the ability. You know, we didn't really have any help from the state leading up to the eventual grand jury announcement and the riots that occurred the last evening. But the truth is, I mean, there were a lot of conversations, a lot of people who said, look, you know, these guys are not going to stop until they take control of this department. We were in the middle. I mean, we were 85-90% done spending several million dollars on renovating it. And the answer for them was, look, our officers can't defend it. At some point, we should consider just letting them have it. And I'm like, what does that mean? I said, well, let them. They're not going to stop until we allow them to go and essentially destroy it, take it over, much like they ended up doing in Minneapolis.
And you're saying at the time that Bob McCullough and Chief Belmar, who was the St. Louis County Police Chief and the Justice Department, they were all kind of encouraging that at the time?
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
That was said multiple times that we need to consider this, that they don't have the staffing. They don't, the officers are exhausted. They went out there. I mean, you think about it, from August till November, going out on the streets almost every night with these protesters. If you go back to, I tried to find the article, but it was either the second or third anniversary. Eventually they did break through the police lines. They did break some windows and throw a Molotov cocktail into the police department. And then that night they spray painted on the side of the building, mission accomplished. Well, they didn't actually burn it down, but I guess they got their pound of flesh in their mind. But, this was something that they continued to try to do every anniversary for several years after that.
Do you know if there was any, one of the things I think we kind of lost in some of this in the last 10 years is the accountability for some of the things that did happen with the protesters. Was there ever anybody really punished for what happened, either in the aftermath of what happened to Mike Brown, or I think some of what you're referring to here happened in November, which is when the grand jury report came out, where there was a decision by Bob McCullough's office to not move forward with charges, mainly because there was nothing to charge him on because he didn't do anything wrong. But that's when some more of the violence occurred later in November.
Correct. And, there were people who were apprehended. There were people who were charged. What the final disposition of a lot of those cases are, that was one of those things we'd always been promised. These people are going to be taken care of. These people are going to be found. There was body cam footage. There was video cam footage. There was security cam footage. Some of these people are going to be tracked down. I know that a lot of that stuff was done, what the disposition of the cases were. I don't think a lot of us really know because we were still right. Neck deep in dealing with the Justice Department, their oversight, their lawsuits, et cetera.
James Knowles is the former Ferguson mayor. I don't know, you probably heard me talk about this a little bit, but, I went back and I refreshed my memory, and I read through at the time all of the grand jury testimony, all of the FBI report and their interviews. There's some variances in those reports because some people didn't go to the grand jury because snitches get stitches, and the FBI did seek them out, and they talked to a lot of these witnesses. And if you just take the time to read the FBI report from Eric Holder and his Department of Justice and Barack Obama's Department of Justice, the narrative comes together pretty clearly. And one of the things I love about the Justice Department report is they go into great detail about the people who lied about this. And by the way, in fairness, there were people that lied on both sides. There were a couple of witnesses that tried to say something about Darren Wilson in his defense that didn't see a damn thing. But there were a lot of people on the other side that just bought into the narrative, James, and just ran with it when the facts were completely the opposite.
Well, and it's frustrating that, at the time, I think a lot of people didn't know what the truth was. Obviously, I think some of us had an idea what the truth was. But once the Justice Department came up with their investigation into the shooting of Michael Brown, a lot of what was said early on should have been dispelled as, complete lies or myths and rumors. And we still do see, unfortunately, now that we have the 10-year anniversary upon us, I mean, I sit there and watch, new documentaries come out and new interviews with people that's rehashing the same old things. The same people who lied on August 10th, who walked out there and said, I saw it, I did this. And the Justice Department report said that person didn't see anything, wasn't anywhere near there. They're still out there. I mean, they're out there on TV. I watch them. I flip around, watch the mainstream news on occasion just to see what the other side's saying. But, it's, when you see that, it's frustrating. I mean, this has been debunked for a decade. These people have been shown to be liars for a decade. Some of these purported witnesses.
Yeah.
And they're back out, recycled again. They're back in new documentaries, and they're back in MSNBC, CNBC, NBC News, saying the same things they said 10 years ago.
Yeah, well, it's reckless journalistic malpractice. It's very frustrating because I've not seen anyone, whether it's print or in broadcast, actually challenge the narrative. They just keep putting the pictures up of the hands up, don't shoot, and they're talking about all the social justice, but they never go to the heart of the case and how hands up, don't shoot and all the rest of it was a complete hoax. And I kind of tied some of these things together either yesterday or the day before, even going back to the Matthew Shepard case from a couple decades ago, because that was sold as this big gay hate crime. Nothing like that. He was a drug dealer, and that's why he was killed by a gay lover, by the way. Then you have Mike Brown. Then you have George Floyd. I mean, the false narratives go on and on and on, and people buy into it. So I don't know if you've watched The Fall of Minneapolis, but that is an extremely enlightening documentary by Liz Collin and some other filmmakers in Minneapolis, and shows people. I would love for the country to watch that and see how their minds would change about all that in a heartbeat, in an instant, James.
Well, and that I did see that movie a few months ago, and I will tell you, I mean, just it starts off with just all the unedited body cam footage, and so you see this, you know, uncut, you know, unnarrated version of the events that happened. And if you put yourself into that situation that those officers were in, I think you would have a very different mindset of how they really handled the situation from start to finish.
Absolutely.
And then you start talking to the officers that were upset, the ones that talked about they had to go to the police department and they thought they were going there to defend it. And they were in fact going there to evacuate it so that they could have it burned. I mean, that really hit me because
yes,
that's exactly the way that's exactly what would have happened to our police department. And that's what was, you know, as I mentioned the other day, was being considered by a number of people who kept saying, you know, we really need to consider this. We cannot keep this up. Eventually they're going to get the department. And they couldn't even tell me what that meant. You know, are they going to loot it? Are they going to break out the windows? What does that mean? You know, in Minneapolis, they burned it down. I mean, they burned down the Quick Trip just down the street from my house where I live. Yeah. I mean, what makes them think they were just going to go break out a couple windows in the police department? It would have been burned down.
It would have been.
If we would have just abandoned it. Absolutely. And I was shocked at the number of people and the people who said, look, you've got to do something. We've got to do something. We can't keep this up. And ultimately we said, look, we're not going to do that. We're not going to allow that to happen. If you want to make that call, you can go out on the news and say that. Nobody had the guts to do that. So thank God they didn't. And we still have a department. But honestly, we have a department that's gone through 10 years of reforms, amazing leadership and Chief Doyle, new officers, training, the absolute most overseen and highly trained officers that we have in this region coming out of that department. And then these people still have nothing to do but complain and mock them and spit at them and complain and try to damage the property. It's completely against the effort.
And, you know, the people that really took the brunt of it 10 years ago, too, were the black police officers. I mean, they were, like you said, they were spat upon. It was revolting what happened to them. And they stood there professionally and they took most of it. Well, James, thanks for reaching out the other day. And again, my apologies for not thinking about you last week. But this is really interesting, just a few days away from this 10th anniversary. So I appreciate coming on here. Hope all is well in your world.
Always. Thanks, Mark.
All right, take care.
That was Mark Reardon being joined by James Knowles, the former mayor of Ferguson, Missouri, as they recollected on just the horrors that occurred following the death of Michael Brown and everything that followed in that, and just what a difficult time it was for the area. Be sure to stick around. We have plenty more coming up to wrap up the 5 o'clock hour. John Seiler on at 5:25, and then Luke Smallbone, my apologies, from Four King and Country, following that. Well, Sue, I realized something. It helps when you have your microphone turned up to be able to communicate that the time check is sponsored by Jerry Kelly Heating and Air. So there's that little tidbit of information for you all out there. We still have a couple of segments left here on this lovely Thursday for the Mark Reardon Show. I'm Ethan Hannaford filling in as Mark enjoys time with his family over the Christmas vacation season. This upcoming interview was from just 8 days ago when Mark was joined by John Seiler, the Director of Higher Education Policy and a Senior Fellow at the Manhattan Institute. Seiler has discussed DEI material with Mark on a couple of occasions, but he specifically joins in this segment to talk about Kansas University's new center, which is meant to oppose anti-trans laws.
John Seiler is back with us. He is a researcher at the National Association of Scholars. We've had him on before exposing a lot of the DEI stuff. He put a story on my radar about KU that I found relatively interesting. John, how are you this evening? Welcome back.
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on again.
Before I get to the KU story, I just went over this on the air, and I'm guessing maybe you've seen the reporting by Luke Rosiak about all these positions that the Biden administration is trying to hire before the end of their term with DEI. Did you see all that?
I did, and that's of great interest to me because, you know, as you know, this is closely connected to what we're seeing at universities, and I think that we have to understand it's a personnel game, and the Biden administration has made a shrewd move, and it'll be interesting to see how the Trump administration responds.
Yeah, because as I indicated, I don't know enough about this, but you do some hiring and you sign paperwork and stuff like that. It's going to be a little difficult maybe for the new administration to undo all that, and that's probably what they're counting on.
Yeah, that's correct. It's always difficult to fire people. It's always difficult to let people go from any position. That's all the more true of people in the federal government. And so, you know, on one hand, this could mean that people have a lot of people aligned with the Biden agenda, especially surrounding issues of identity, have access to power and control. But it also, you know, I think about this. This is also sort of you can think of it in terms of patronage. This is a way of rewarding a lot of people who align with your political goals, even if they don't end up having any power in the federal government. They'll still probably, a lot of them, could very well stick around for a long time and take a salary funded by us.
But, John, aren't you just a little bummed out that you're not a race grifter making $300,000 a year? Because these things tend to pay pretty well.
I mean, if I've learned anything, it's that the cash continues to flow into this sort of this sort of enterprise. So, yeah, maybe I should take my lesson and you know, if I ever need a backup job, maybe that's the way to go.
Well, let's talk about the University of Kansas. I'm a University of Missouri guy, so we do not much care for the University of Kansas, although our jealousy has kind of gotten a little out of hand over the years. But you put something on my radar, as I indicated, that's very, very interesting. And, you know, I had Jamie Reed on the show two nights ago. Jamie is our whistleblower from here in St. Louis with the WashU Children's Hospital Transgender-Affirming Care Clinic, which is now no longer, thanks to Jamie, and a lot of people who shed light on that particular topic, including me, I would say. But the folks in Kansas haven't gotten the message on some of this yet, have they, John?
No, and that's what I found when I did some investigative digging into a new program at the University of Kansas. So the other day for the City Journal, where I publish, I'm now a fellow at the Manhattan Institute, so I publish a lot. I'm doing a lot of investigative work for City Journal. I published a story about how the University of Kansas has created a center that aims to recruit, in their words, scholar activists, and actually other activists who are not even scholars, to explicitly fight what they call anti-trans laws and anti-trans legislation, both in Kansas and around the country. This center that is housed in the public university in Kansas is making its explicit goal to fight policies that were supported by a supermajority of the elected officials in Kansas. That is a remarkable way to pit a university against the people it is ostensibly supposed to serve.
So they write things like trans studies, like trans lives, is under severe threat on a national scale, right? So they're basically trying to tell people that this is an important position, an important organization because of evil Republicans.
Yeah. So to give background on the story and the scoop, the Andrew Mellon Foundation, which is this very progressive, very wealthy charitable foundation, gave a grant to support a part of this initiative. That's, you know, the university itself has skin in the game. This initiative is housed in the University of Kansas. And if you read through the document, they actually describe how after a while, some of the personnel who are hired through the program will be funded exclusively by the university. So this is a long-term financial commitment by KU. And what because this is a public university and they made a proposal for a grant, I was able to acquire that proposal through a public records request. And in that request, or in that proposal, they lay out exactly what this initiative at the, at, you know, the flagship state university is supposed to do. And they start by saying trans lives are under attack. And why are they under attack? They specifically point to legislation in Kansas and around the country that is meant to push back on the, you know, truly concerning rise of gender ideology. They talk about things like the decision by the Kansas Attorney General to keep biological sex on state ID.
Yeah, they call that heart-wrenching, really, right? They call that a heart-wrenching decision by, you know, the AG.
This is an incredibly reasonable thing to do. And it's in certain cases actually important to make sure that if you're identified and but not necessarily able to identify yourself, that people have this kind of information. But according to the document that I acquired, the entire purpose of creating this new initiative that's supposed to recruit new professors to the university and recruit activists, scholar activists throughout the country is really to fight that kind of law. And they also just vaguely reference how the ACLU has collected a number of, or has documented a number of instances around the country where legislatures have pushed back against what I would describe as gender ideology. And now they say this is happening in Kansas too, and that's a really bad thing. And that's why we need to create this initiative to garner this money, to get the support of outside funders and the university. And if you look at what Kansas has actually done, they've passed reasonable laws. They've passed laws relating to, you know, keeping boys out of girls' sports, things like that. These are not the most controversial laws, even in just in the realm of pushing back against gender ideology. And what's really remarkable about this is that after the election of Donald Trump, I think a lot of people acknowledged two things. Even people on, you know, the left of center, they acknowledged that, first of all, identity politics and particularly gender ideology has gone too far. And there was a public mandate, a public response to the national messaging about that issue in particular that was a part of the story of Trump getting elected. People have pointed to various ads that he's run and said, you know, bringing up the trans issue was really effective.
Yeah, and it was
time, they've said
it was effective because it's what I call a 90-10 issue. 90%, if not more, people in this country are on our side of this, right? It's a small, and it's apparently people who write proposals for universities, because as you note in your work on this, they say in the proposal that this would have ripple effects. Adding another trans studies scholar would have ripple effects and could draw a larger pool of trans studies focused graduate students. So they're really pushing this. They're tone deaf to where the rest of the world is, not only the country, but the rest of the world is on this. And I think it's good that it's being exposed. Now, exposing it, John, will it have any consequences for KU, do you think?
Well, you know, that's a really important point you raised, because what we're seeing here is just a kind of microcosm of what is going on more broadly, which is that universities and outside funders like the federal government and foundations are creating a pipeline, a career pipeline for scholar activists, for people who want to turn universities into a vehicle for activism, which, by the way, makes people really object to what universities do in general. Now, will there be any effect? I really hope so. You know, sometimes there's a reasonable argument to make that, well, maybe this program that is relatively controversial, it's protected by academic freedom. There are legitimate arguments to make about some programs that a lot of people would even say, this is a 90-10 issue. Why is a university doing this? Well, we protect controversial ideas, or we allow controversial ideas in universities. But this is a different case. This is not just a professor saying something that a lot of people disagree with, or saying something that sounds radical. That's something that you should protect. But what you don't have to protect at all is a university saying that it wants to engage in an explicitly partisan political project. The document even identifies with the progressive culture of its town. It talks positively about how the city of Lawrence is this blue dot in a sea of red, referring to how it's aligned with the Democratic Party, right. And they talk about that in a way that this is really a good thing. That's absolutely corrosive. But to this is, any kind yeah. of healthy university system.
This is what they do. This is exactly what happens. And John, let me share this story. And I was very disappointed. I had a very awkward start to the show because yesterday, and it was like a Christmas gift was dropped into my lap as a radio guy. There was a listener who reached out that had this audio from my alma mater in the journalism school at the University of Missouri. And they shared it with me. And this was from the day after the election. And it is, it's pretty stunning, even for someone like me. Well, I was given permission to use it, I thought. And then there was a little panic that set in because they didn't want the student being affected. And I understand that, certainly as a parent. But the story that I shared without playing the audio, and I committed to not playing it at this point, maybe when the kid graduates, and I'm going to hang on to this. And I don't want to get anyone in trouble, and I'm not using names. But listen to this story, because the trans issue came up from this professor, and that's something that he was pushing in this class. But then, this is a little bit separate, but I think you'll appreciate the punchline here. So there are two girls. There's a girl in the class that starts telling this story about her and her friend, and her friend has a dog, and the dog, I think they were out in the woods or doing something. The dog has bugs all over it. They're not sure. They had flea and tick on it, so they didn't know what was going on. They see all these ticks, so they run it to this vet clinic. The vet clinic, though, has Trump signs, campaign signs out in front. So the girl's horrified by the evilness that's inside the vet clinic, right? So they go in with the dog. They're terribly, upset by the fact that these are Trump folks, and they tell them what happened, and the receptionist and the people at the vet clinic are super, overwhelmingly nice. The girl admits this in her storytelling, and they basically say, oh, this is easy. The dog has, these seat ticks. Just use this spray. We don't even have to charge you for anything. So the takeaway from this girl wasn't, man, that's pretty nice of the vet clinic to do that. They're Trump supporters. I wouldn't have expected that. The takeaway was, this is what they do. This is what the evil Nazis do. They'll throw you a bone of generosity, even though they represent the most vile things on the planet. That was the actual takeaway from this girl. And you can't tell me that that's not been pounded in her little tiny brain from professors like the one that I wish to highlight at Mizzou and even high school indoctrinators. But that was quite stunning. So I guess my point is this doesn't surprise me with KU. I'm sure that you haven't been surprised along the way in exposing a lot of this, because this is the Marxism that exists on these college campuses.
And, it's really remarkable to see how it's not just that university professors happen to be very, very progressive. What we're seeing is universities making a commitment to recruit people on the basis of their progressivism.
That's right.
And on the basis of their commitment to activism. It doesn't happen all the time. But when you have department, in this proposal, they talk about how they're going to hire another professor who specializes in transgender studies. And now the way that discipline is structured, it's not just anyone using social science to study the phenomenon of people with gender, gender confusion. This is a tendentious discipline. This is a discipline that's devoted to advancing a particular idea. And what they're doing is creating a career path for people who want to spend their lives advancing these ideas. And they're doing it effectively on the public dime. And they're also doing it in the one institution that we have in this country that is supposed to be devoted to the pursuit of truth. There is an active effort by foundations, by federal funders, by universities and university systems that's still ongoing and might actually ramp up as a new administration comes in that they oppose, an active effort to recruit more people who align with this vision for higher education.
It's revolting.
Absolutely. Absolutely a trap.
And to bring it full circle, these are the people being, indoctrinated and trained, if you will, at these universities that are also applying for the $310,000 DEI job for the federal government. So the taxpayers get hit in a double dipping way. John, great work as always. Have a great Christmas. I appreciate coming on here.
Thanks so much.
Welcome back to the Mark Reardon Show on 97.1 FM Talk. I'm Ethan Hannaford, filling in, taking you through some best of segments from throughout the 2024 year. And we wrap up around 5:45 on a Thursday afternoon, our final best of the day. Susan Lynn joins Mark Reardon, a writer and psychologist who's a strong advocate for banning cell phones, smartphones specifically, from schools. Mark also made it clear that he's a strong advocate for this during the interview, and they have quite the conversation about what that process would look like and what kind of growth that they have seen.
I am very passionate about this, keeping cell phones out of schools. I don't understand why this has not become a national thing. I don't know why. I'd kind of like to hear something out of the White House on this particular topic. Now, maybe this is because I have a little girl and my other kids are in their 20s right now. They're long past the age of, you know, making a decision on when to give them a cell phone or having them affected by social media. All that damage has been done. But it's a serious issue. And Susan Lynn has written about this. She is the author of Who's Raising the Kids? Big Tech, Big Business, and the Lives of Children. She joins us this afternoon. Hi, Susan. How are you? Welcome to 97.1 FM Talk in St. Louis.
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
I'm good, but I don't know why more school districts across the country aren't taking a stand and saying, nope, no schools are going to have cell phones and stuff like that. It seems like this is still a little bit slow on the uptick.
I think, as somebody who's been an activist in this arena for a long time, I think actually it's amazing that as many schools that recently have started creating policies. I think that's just, you know, amazing that that's happening. There's such a, you know, a pushback from tech companies about these phones and marketing them as educational and everybody needs them. And, you know, they absolutely should not be in schools.
Yeah, I don't think
that's
good. Yeah, it's good to hear that you're a little bit more optimistic. So you actually feel, if I heard you correctly there, that this momentum is actually resulting in some good decisions and this is catching on a bit?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, if you look, there have been just a lot of stories in the media recently about schools, individual schools, school districts that are changing their policy on cell phones and banning them. I mean, some schools are just doing it in classrooms, mm-hmm. but other schools, I think, are taking a better and more pro-child approach, actually, by saying that kids basically can't use phones in schools at all.
I want to get to the phone issue here in a second specifically, but I do find it interesting. Your background is and this goes back a couple of decades plus, you formed something called Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood. And one of the things that you cite in your piece that I read was some success with Disney on the topic of what they used to put out. I remember these. I probably even bought some of these baby Einstein videos, right?
Yes.
So what happened?
That's right.
What happened with that? Did you sue them because they were falsely marketing it?
We weren't parties to the suit, but we worked with the lawyers who you know, it was basically the idea for the suit came from us, and they threatened a lawsuit. What happened is that Disney came back and offered refunds, and that made the front page of the New York Times and papers all over. News, I guess it was newspapers then, all over the world. And it really hurt baby Einstein's business. I mean, they're not educational. There's no evidence that screens are educational for babies. And there's mounting evidence, in fact, that they're potentially harmful because what they're finding are brain changes in areas of the brain that that affect decision making and self-regulation, executive function. I mean, these are attributes that are essential for schools. I mean, the whole addiction to screens is starting with infants.
Yeah.
We're seeing it. I mean, it's more dramatic with adolescents because, you know, there are, you know, a lot of adolescent health issues associated with social media, including, you know, depression, suicide. And what the phones do is provide access to screens all the time, really 24 hours a day. And the kids, they need some relief, and that's something that schools can easily do.
One of my favorite things that happened over the summer, my daughter went to this camp down in the southern part of Missouri near Rolla called Cup Creek Science Camp. There's a lot of kids from this area that go, and there was no even, you couldn't even have your, she's got an Apple Watch just to communicate, but there was no even ability to communicate with that, which I was a big fan of, by the way. But I bring it up because, let's face it, and I'm a fan of Jonathan Haidt's book, The Anxious Generation. I think people need to read that. I think you would agree, but there's a lot of parents that are unwilling to take some of these steps. Aren't there? Isn't that part of the problem?
Yes.
Or maybe is the problem.
And it is a problem. Well, the real problem is the way that the tech industry markets their devices to kids, and also falsely to parents, again, claiming, for instance, that they're educational for babies when they're not. It's hard, as you know, it's hard to be a parent today. So I think that that one of the problems that parents have, I mean, the argument that they bring up is, what if there's, a terrible thing happens in school, and how is my child going to get in touch and
right,
that kind
right.
of thing? Right, right. But if you really think about it, the damage that the phones do, they're so distracting. I mean, we're all addicted to our phones.
Oh, absolutely.
And they're phenomenally, distracting. I mean, there's even research that's suggesting that just having a phone on a table during a meal lowers the quality of the conversation during that meal.
I believe it. I absolutely believe it. I think a lot of us, I've tried to maybe take some conscious steps in leaving the phone in the car when you're having dinner with friends or things along those lines. But I'll admit, it's not easy to do, especially with someone like me. I'm connected to the news. I want to know what's happening. I'm checking the Twitter all the time. So it's very tough. But adults making these decisions and being addicted is very, very different than some of the things that are happening to these adolescent brains.
Yes. I mean, that's absolutely true. And there's research showing, for instance, that around the world, students distracted by phones in schools actually score significantly lower on what's called the PISA math assessment. And also, there are lots of other studies also that reflect those same findings. And there's one from the London School of Economics showing that the rise in test scores after students are not allowed phones in schools, that the rise in test scores was specifically due to the improved performance by students who were identified as low achievers.
So what kind, do you have any hopes in particular for this administration? Look, I'm a big fan of government staying out of things, right? But in a situation like this, when you don't have cooperation from tech, that's when people start talking about government involvement, right?
Right, yes. And I mean, one of the things is that most of the power in running schools comes from states and cities and communities, districts, right? I mean, so I think a national ban would be really hard to do. But what's happening is that districts, schools, even states are starting to take steps in that direction.
I'm encouraged by that.
I said, I've been doing this work for a long time.
Right.
I am optimistic about this.
Well, I love to hear the optimism because it's something that I'm more dialed into. Look, I would admit that I probably wouldn't be as concerned about this. I wouldn't be as dialed into this if I didn't have a little screen user in my house right now, because things were different. When my kids were that age, well, the iPhone was just coming out. We had cell phones, but the iPhone and all that was just coming out. So now this is so prevalent, and, I get concerned. I know I've talked to the principal at her school about this. I can see how teachers are trying to do things, and sometimes they're pulling their hair out. So, look, I think this is an important issue, and I hope that we hear some national discourse on this. But, Susan, thanks so much for joining me here on 97.1 FM Talk. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
All right, take care. That's Susan Lynn, who has written about that topic as well. Look, I'd put Jonathan Haidt's book on your Christmas list to someone that is close to you, because The Anxious Generation is an important message.
That was Mark Reardon with Susan Lynn. fascinating conversation about the potential banning of smartphones in elementary schools. And that just about wraps up today's edition of The Mark Reardon Show. More action coming to you tomorrow. Frank Cusimano, Paul Hall will be joining live. We'll have Sue's news and much more. Thanks so much for joining me today, Sue. Greatly appreciate it. A Merry Christmas to you. And we wrap up saying adios until tomorrow.
Get more at 971talk.com.